something major was happening in the palace. There was the occasional crash of a floor or thump of a falling ceiling. In his rat-filled dungeon, behind a door with more locks than a major canal network, the patrician of Ankh-Morpork lay back and grinned in the darkness. Outside, bonfires flared in the dusk. Ankh-Morpork was celebrating. No one was quite sure why, but they'd worked themselves up for a celebration tonight. Barrels had been broached, oxen had been put on spits, one paper hat and a celebratory mug had been issued per child, and it seemed a shame to waste all that effort. Anyway, it had been a very interesting day, and the people of Ankh-Morpork set great store by entertainment.
"The way I see it," said one of the revellers halfway through a huge greasy lump of half-raw meat, "a dragon as king mightn't be a bad idea, when you think it through, is what I mean."
"It definitely looked very gracious," said the woman to his right, as if testing the idea. "Sort of, well, sleek, nice and smart, not scruffy, takes a bit of pride in itself." She glared at some of the younger revellers further down the table. "The trouble with people today is they don't take pride in themselves."
"And there's a foreign policy, of course," said a third, helping himself to a rib, "when you come to think about it."
"What do you mean?"
"Diplomacy," said the rib-eater, flatly.
They thought about it, and then you could see them turning the idea around and thinking about it the other way, in a polite effort to see what the hell he was getting at.
"Dunno," said the monarchical expert slowly. "I mean, your actual dragon has got these, basically, two sort of ways of negotiation, hasn't it? I mean, it's either roasting you alive, nor it isn't. Correct me if I'm wrong," he added.
"That's my point. I mean, let's say the ambassador from Klatch comes along. You know how arrogant that lot are. Suppose he says, 'We want this, we want that, we want the other thing.' Well," he said, beaming at them, "what we say is, 'Shut your face unless you want to go home in a jar.'"
They tried out this idea for mental fit. It had that certain something.
"They've got a big fleet, Klatch," said the monarchist uncertainly. "Could be a bit risky roasting diplomats. People who see a pile of charcoal come back on the boat, they tend to look a bit askance."
"Ah, then we say, 'Oh there, Johnny Klatchian, you know like 'em big fella lizard belong sky, bake mud hut belong you pretty damn chop chop.'"
"We could really say that?"
"Why not? And then we say, 'Send plenty tribute, toot sweet.'"
"I never did like them Klatchians," said the woman firmly. "The stuff they eat, it's disgusting. And gabbling away all the time in their heathen lingo."
In the shadows, a match flared. Vimes cupped his hands around the flame, sucked on the foul tobacco, tossed the match into the gutter, and slouched off down the damp, puddle-punctuated alley. If there was anything that depressed him more than his own cynicism, it was that, quite often, it still wasn't as cynical as real life. "We've got along with the other guys for centuries," he thought. "Getting along has practically been all our foreign policy. And now I think I've just heard us declare war on an ancient civilization that we've always got along with, more or less, even if they do talk funny. And after that, the world. What's worse, we'll probably win." Similar thoughts, although with a different perspective, were going through the minds of the civic leaders of Ankh-Morpork, when, next morning, each received a short note bidding them to be at the palace for a working lunch, by order. It didn't say by whose order, or, they noted, whose lunch. Now they were assembled in the antechamber. And there had been changes. It had never been what you might call a select place. The patrician had always felt that if you made people comfortable, they might want to stay. The furniture had been a few very elderly chairs, and around the walls portraits of earlier city rulers holding scrolls and things. The chairs were still there, the portraits were not. Or rather, the stained and cracked canvases were piled in a corner, but the gilt frames were gone. The councillors tried to avoid one another's faces and sat tapping their fingers on their knees. Finally, a couple of very worried-looking servants opened the doors to the main hall. Lupine once lurched through. Most of the councillors had been up all night anyway, trying to formulate some kind of policy vis-à-vis dragons. But once looked as though he hadn't been to sleep in years. His face was the colour of a fermented dishcloth, Never particularly well padded, he now looked like something out of a pyramid.
"Ah," he intoned, "good. Are you all here? Then perhaps you would step this way, gentlemen?"
"Ah," said the head thief, "the note mentioned lunch."
"Yes," said Wants.
"With a dragon?"
"Good grief, you don't think it would eat you, do you?" said Wants. "What an idea!"
"Never crossed me mind," said the head thief, relief blowing from his ears like steam. "The very idea."
said the chief merchant.
said the head assassin. "The very idea." "No, I expect you're all far too stringy," said Wants.
Ha ha ha.
The temperature lowered by several degrees.
"So if you would kindly step this way."
The great hall had changed. For one thing, it was a great deal greater. Several walls had been knocked into adjoining rooms, and the ceiling and several stories of upper rooms had been entirely removed. The floor was a mass of rubble, except in the middle of the room, which was a heap of gold. Well, gold-ish. It looked as though someone had scoured the palace for anything that shone or glittered. There were the picture frames and the gold thread out of the tapestries, and silver and the occasional gem. There were also tureens from the kitchens, candlesticks, warming pans, fragments of mirror, sparkly stuff. The councillors were not in a position to pay much attention to this, however, because of what was hanging above their heads. It looked like the biggest badly rolled cigar in the universe, if the biggest badly rolled cigar in the universe was in the habit of hanging upside down. Two talons could dimly be seen gripping the dark rafters. Halfway between the glittering heap and the doorway, a small table had been laid. The councillors noted without much surprise that the familiar ancient silverware was missing. There were china plates and cutlery that looked as though it had very recently been whittled from bits of wood. Wants took a seat at the head of the table and nodded to the servants.
"Please be seated, gentlemen," he said. "I am sorry, things are a little different, but the king hopes you will bear with it until matters can be more suitably organized."
The said the head merchant.
"The king," repeated Wants.
His voice sounded one dribble away from madness.
"Oh, the king. Right," said the merchant.
From where he was sitting, he had a good view of the big hanging thing. There seemed to be some movement there, some trembling in the great folds that wrapped it.
"Long life to him, say I,"
he added quickly. The first course was soup with dumplings in it. Wants didn't have any. The rest of them ate in a terrified silence broken only by the dull chiming of wood on china.
"There are certain matters of decree to which the king feels your assent would be welcome," said Wants, eventually. "A pure formality, of course, and I'm sorry to bother you with such petty detail."
The big bundle appeared to sway in the breeze.
"No trouble at all," squeaked the head thief. "The king graciously desires it to be known," said Wants, "that it would be pleased to receive coronation gifts from the population at large. Nothing complex, of course, simply any precious metals or gems they might have by them, and can easily spare. I should stress, by the way, that this is by no means compulsory. Such generosity, as he is confident of expecting, should be an entirely voluntary act."
The chief assassin looked sadly at the rings on his fingers and sighed. The head merchant was already resignedly unshipping his gilt chain of office from around his neck.
"Why, gentlemen," said Wants, "this is most unexpected."
Said
the Arch-Chancellor of Unseen University,
"you will be, that is, I'm sure the king is aware that, traditionally, the university is exempt from all city levies and taxes."
He stifled a yawn. The wizards had spent the night directing their best spells against the dragon. It was like punching fog.
"My dear sir, this is no levy," protested Wants. "I hope that nothing I have said would lead you to expect anything like that.
Oh, no. No, any tribute should be, as I said, entirely voluntary. I hope that is absolutely clear.
As crystal, said the head assassin, glaring at the old wizard.
And these entirely voluntary tributes we are about to make, they go...
On the hoard, said Once.
Ah. Well, I am positive the people of the city will be very generous indeed, once they fully understand the situation, said the head merchant. I am sure the king will understand that there is very little gold in Ankh-Morpork.
Good point, said Once. However, the king intends to pursue a vigorous and dynamic foreign policy, which should remedy matters.
Ah, the councillors chorused, rather more enthusiastically this time.
For example, Once went on, the king feels that our legitimate interests in Quirm, Stolat, Pseudopolis, and Sort have been seriously compromised in recent centuries. This will be speedily corrected, and, gentlemen, I can assure you that treasure will positively flow into the city from those anxious to enjoy the king's protection.
The head assassin glanced at the hoard. A very definite idea formed in his mind as to where all that treasure would end up. You had to admire the way dragons knew how to put the bite on. It was practically human.
Oh, he said.
Of course, there will probably be other acquisitions in the way of land, property, and so forth, and the king wishes it to be fully understood that the loyal privy councillors will be richly rewarded.
And, said the head assassin, who was beginning to feel that he had got a firm grip on the nature of the king's mental processes.
No doubt the, privy councillors, said Once, no doubt they will respond with even greater generosity in the matter of, for example, treasure.
I am sure such considerations haven't even crossed the king's mind, said Once, but the point is very well made.
I thought it would be.
The next course was fat pork, beans, and floury potatoes. More, as they couldn't help noticing, fattening food.
Once had a glass of water.
Which brings us on to a further matter of some delicacy, which I am sure that well-travelled, broad-minded gentlemen such as yourselves will have no difficulty in accepting, he said.
The hand holding the glass was beginning to shake.
I hope it will also be understood by the population at large, especially since the king will undoubtedly be able to contribute in so many ways to the well-being and defence of the city. For example, I am sure that the people will rest more contentedly in their beds knowing that the king is tirelessly protecting them from harm. There can, however, be ridiculous, ancient prejudices, which will only be eradicated by ceaseless work on the part of all men of goodwill.
He paused and looked at them.
The head assassin said later that he had looked into the eyes of many men who obviously were very near death, but he had never looked into eyes that were so clearly and unmistakably looking back at him from the slopes of hell. He hoped he would never, he said, ever have to look into eyes like that again.
I am referring, said Once, each word coming slowly to the surface like bubbles in some quicksand, to the matter of the king's diet.
There was a terrible silence. They heard the faint rustle of wings behind them, and the shadows in the corners of the hall grew darker and seemed to close in.
Diet, said the head thief in a hollow voice.
Yes, said Once. His voice was almost a squeak. Sweat was dripping down his face. The head assassin had once heard the word rictus, and wondered when you should use it correctly to describe someone's expression, and now he knew. That was what Once's face had become. It was the ghastly rictus of someone trying not to hear the words his own mouth was saying.
We thought, said the head assassin, very carefully, that the king,
well, must have been arranging matters for himself over the weeks.
Ah, but poor stuff, you know, poor stuff, stray animals and so forth, said Once, staring hard at the tabletop. Obviously, as king,
Such makeshifts are no longer appropriate.
The silence grew and took on a texture. The councillors thought hard, especially about the meal they had just eaten. The arrival of a huge trifle with a lot of cream on it only served to concentrate their minds.
Said the head merchant, how often is the king hungry?
All the time, said Once, but it eats once a month. It is really a ceremonial occasion.
Of course, said the head merchant, it would be.
And, said the head assassin, when did the king last eat?
I'm sorry to say it hasn't eaten properly ever since it came here, said Once.
Oh.
You must understand, said Once, fiddling desperately with his wooden cutlery, that merely waylaying people like some common assassin...
Excuse me, the head assassin began.
Some common murderer, I mean. There is no satisfaction there. The whole essence of the king's feeding is that it should be, well... an act of bonding between king and subjects. It is perhaps a living allegory, reinforcing the close links between the crown and the community, he added.
The precise nature of the meal, the head thief began, almost choking on the words, are we talking about young maidens here?
Sheer prejudice, said Once. The age is immaterial. Marital status is, of course, of importance, and social class. Something to do with flavour, I believe.
He leaned forward, and now his voice was pain-filled and urgent, and they felt genuinely his own for the first time.
Please consider it, he hissed. After all, just one a month. In exchange for so much. The families of people of use to the king, privy councillors such as yourselves, would not, of course, even be considered. And when you think of the alternatives...
They didn't just think about all the alternatives. It was enough to think about just one of them. The silence purred at them as Once talked. They avoided one another's faces for fear of what they might see mirrored there. Each man thought... one of the others is bound to say something soon, some protest, and then I'll murmur agreement, not actually say anything, I'm not as stupid as that, but definitely murmur very firmly so that the others will be in no doubt that I thoroughly disapprove, because at a time like this it behooves all decent men to nearly stand up and be almost heard. But no one said anything. The cowards, each man thought. And no one touched the pudding, or the brick-thick chocolate mince served afterwards. They just listened in flushed, gloomy horror as Once's voice droned on, and when they were dismissed they tried to leave as separately as possible so that they didn't have to talk to one another. Except for the head merchant, that is. He found himself leaving the palace with the chief assassin, and they strolled side by side, minds racing. The chief merchant tried to look on the bright side. He was one of those men who organise sing-songs when things go drastically wrong.
"Well, well," he said. "So, we're privy councillors now. Just fancy."
"Hmm,"
said the assassin.
"I wonder what's the difference between ordinary councillors and privy councillors,"
wondered the merchant aloud. The assassin scowled at him.
"I think," he said, "it is because you're expected to eat shit."
He turned the glare back on its feet again. What kept going through his mind were Once's last words as he shook the secretary's limp hand. He wondered if anyone else had heard them. Unlikely. They'd been a shape rather than a sound. Once had simply moved his lips around them while staring fixedly at the assassin's moon-tanned face.
Help me.
The assassin shivered. Why him? As far as he could see, there was only one kind of help he was qualified to give, and very few people ever asked for it for themselves. In fact, they usually paid large sums for it to be given as a surprise present to other people. He wondered what was happening to Once that made any alternative seem better. Once sat alone in the dark, ruined hall, waiting. He could try running, but it would find him again. It would always be able to find him. It could smell his mind. Or it would flame him. That was worse, just like the brethren. Perhaps it was an instantaneous death. It looked an instantaneous death, but once lay awake at night wondering whether those last microseconds somehow stretched to a subjective white-hot eternity, every tiny part of your body a mere smear of plasma, and you there, alive, in the middle of it all.
Not you. I would not flame you.
It wasn't telepathy. As far as once had always understood it, telepathy was like hearing a voice in your head. This was like hearing a voice in your body. His whole nervous system twanged to it like a bow.
Rise.
Once jerked to his feet, overturning the chair and banging his legs on the table. When that voice spoke, he had as much control over his body as water had over gravity.
Come.
Once lurched across the floor. The wings unfolded slowly with the occasional creak until they filled the hall from side to side. The tip of one smashed a window and stuck out into the afternoon air. The dragon slowly, sensuously stretched out its neck and yawned. When it had finished, it brought its head round until it was a few inches in front of Once's face.
What does voluntary mean?
It means doing something of your own free will, said Once.
But they have no free will. They will increase my hoard, or I will flame them.
Once gulped.
Yes, he said, but you mustn't...
The silent roar of fury spun him round.
There is nothing I mustn't.
No, 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 squeaked Once, clutching his head. I didn't mean that. Believe me, this way is better, that's all, better and safer.
None can defeat me.
This is certainly the case.
None can control me.
Once flung up his finger-spread hands in a conciliatory fashion.
Of course, he said, but there are ways and ways, you know, ways and ways. All the roaring and flaming, you see, you don't need it.
Foolish ape, how else can I make them do my bidding?
Once put his hands behind his back.
They'll do it of their own free will, he said, and in time they'll come to believe it was their own idea. It'll be a tradition. Take it from me, we humans are adaptable creatures.
The dragon gave him a long, blank stare.
In fact, said Once, trying to keep the trembling out of his voice, before too long, if someone comes along and tells them that a dragon king is a bad idea, they'll kill him themselves.
The dragon blinked. For the first time Once could remember, it seemed uncertain.
I know people, you see, said Once, simply.
The dragon continued to pin him with its gaze.
If you are lying, it thought eventually,
you know I can't, not to you.
And they really act like this?
Oh, yes, all the time. It's a basic human trait.
Once knew the dragon could read at least the upper levels of his mind. They resonated in terrible harmony, and he could see the mighty thoughts behind the eyes in front of him. The dragon was horrified.
I'm sorry, said Once weakly. That's just how we are. It's all to do with survival, I think.
There will be no mighty warriors sent to kill me,
it thought, almost plaintively.
I don't think so.
No heroes?
Not any more. They cost too much.
But I will be eating people,
Once whimpered. He felt the sensation of the dragon rummaging around in his mind, trying to find a clue to understanding. He half saw, half sensed the flicker of random images, of dragons, of the mythical age of reptiles, and here he felt the dragon's genuine astonishment, of some of the less commendable areas of human history, which were most of it. And after the astonishment came the baffled anger. There was practically nothing the dragon could do to people that they had not sooner or later tried on one another, often with enthusiasm.
"You have the effrontery to be squeamish," it thought at him. "But we were dragons. We were supposed to be cruel, cunning, heartless, and terrible. But this much I can tell you, you ape."
The great face pressed even closer so that once was staring into the pitiless depths of his eyes.
"We never burned and tortured and ripped one another apart and called it morality."
The dragon stretched its wings again once or twice, and then dropped heavily onto the tawdry assortment of mildly precious things. Its claws scrabbled at the pile. It sneered.
"A three-legged lizard wouldn't hoard this lot," it thought. "There will be better things," whispered once,
temporarily relieved at the change in direction.
"There had better be." "Can I,"
once hesitated, "can I ask you a question?"
"Ask."
"You don't need to eat people, surely? I think that's the only problem from people's point of view, you see," he added, his voice speeding up to a gabble. "The treasure and everything, that doesn't have to be a problem. But if it's just a matter of, well, protein, then perhaps it has occurred to a powerful intellect such as your own that something less controversial, like a cow, might..." The dragon breathed a horizontal streak of fire that calcined the opposite wall.
"Need? Need?"
it roared when the sound had died away.
"You talk to me of need. Isn't it the tradition that the finest flower of womanhood should be sent to the dragon to ensure peace and prosperity?"
"But you see, we have always been moderately peaceful and reasonably prosperous."
"Do you want this state of affairs to continue?"
The force of the thought drove once to his knees.
"Of course," he managed.
The dragon stretched its claws luxuriantly.
"Then the need is not mine. It is yours," it thought. "Now get out of my sight."
Once sagged as it left his mind. The dragon slithered over the cut-price hoard, leapt up onto the ledge of one of the hall's big windows, and smashed the stained glass with its head. The multicoloured image of a city father cascaded into the other debris below. The long neck stretched out into the early evening air and turned like a seeking needle. Lights were coming on across the city. The sound of a million people being alive made a muted, deep thrumming. The dragon breathed deeply, joyfully. Then it hauled the rest of its body onto the ledge, shouldered the remains of the window's frame aside, and leapt into the sky.